All right, we welcome everyone here to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case for oral argument on our 10:30 docket. M&M Joint Venture and Ledford White versus Gwendolyn Jean Layton and Troy Lynn Ann Layton. Cause number 215-357-CV out of Tarrant County. First, let me introduce our justices today. To my right, Justice Leanne Dofino. To my left, Justice Bonnie Sudreth. And I'm Chief Justice Terry Livingston. Now, I understand the attorneys have checked in, and your time has been divided between two different counsel on the preliminary argument, and then we will hear the reply, and then there will be a short rebuttal that y'all are sharing. So I think I've got that right. Because we have to change the timing mechanism, we'll need just a moment to get the timer caught up with what we're doing. So there might be just a short pause, if you all don't mind. So I believe first we have Ryan Anderson to argue for the appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Ryan Anderson, and I am here on behalf of appellant M&M Joint Venture. We appreciate the opportunity to present oral argument today. Our concern, of course, is that this case threatens to turn existing lien law and constructive trust law in Texas on its head. What the Laytons have attempted to do and are attempting to do here is to turn unsecured loans made in 1997 and 2000 into an ownership or security interest in particular real property some 15 years later and after the fact. We contend, of course, that this cannot legally be done, and on this record before the court should not be done. We brought with us from the record defendants M&M's Exhibit 17. It's a timeline that Mr. Layton agreed to in trial as an accurate outline of the pertinent events surrounding this case and the loans at issue here. The first loan was made with a note of $30,000 to non-party Alton Isabel in 1997, and a second $250,000 loan, which is unsecured and virtually undocumented but for a check, in the year 2000. Now, by way of reminder, Alton Isabel was a party to this litigation until he filed bankruptcy. He is no longer a party to this litigation and was not at the time of trial. M&M Joint Venture did not exist in 1997 or 2000. It did not exist in 2001 when the Laytons learned that the Kroger deal that they had supposedly invested in was about to sell. It did not exist until 2003. The brief background on M&M, which is in the record, but and which frankly the court may be aware of due to another case that came before it out of the 96th District Court, that judgment is in our record, but M&M is a joint venture that is currently owned 50% by non-party to this litigation, Kent Davis, and Kent also has a 50%, or not only the 50% interest, but a charging order on the other 50% interest currently held by Ledford White. That constructive trust that Kent has that got him the 50% interest in the charging order is by virtue of that case out of the 96th District Court that was appealed through this court and then back down, of course. And that judgment was entered in April of 2013. The charging order on Ledford White's 50% interest was entered in May of 2013, and the Laytons filed this case in August of 2013. As it regards the timeline, as is in the record, the Laytons made these unsecured loans to Alton Isabel for development of a Kroger property down in Crowley on the west side of 731. I think it bears pointing out that the record shows that the Laytons were not the only or even perhaps the primary investors in this project that Alton Isabel was running. They were but one piece of a much larger project with multiple investors. After learning about Kroger supposedly about to sell in 2001, the next thing on the timeline, 4 to 5 years later, is Layton determines for himself by driving by, essentially, that it had in fact been built. 2 years after that, he supposedly talks to Ledford White the conversation there was that his money was in other property. What was not part of that conversation, according to this record, was any kind of discussion along the lines of, well, Mr. Layton, here's what you could stand to get paid out today. Would you like to reinvest and do another deal? Would you like to get additional consideration to let us hold on to your money for longer? Nothing like that was in the record in that conversation. That conversation was, the money's already tied up somewhere else and you'll be repaid, another promise of repayment, when that other property sells.
Excuse me a minute. Wasn't there, though, continuing promises every time the Laytons would try to collect on the debt to then White might represent that there would be yet another investment that maybe was bigger and better in which they could invest funds?
Something along those lines, yes, absolutely. As it pertains to the property at issue here, though, I think this timeline certainly doesn't highlight everything that's in the case, and I don't mean to represent that it does, but the pertinent big milestone issues. The important takeaway that I hope that we can take from this is that Mr. Layton did not start talking about where's my money until 2007 or 2008, at which point, according to the testimony, Ledford had told him it was already being used for something else. It was certainly already being used for something else. And I understand that their argument is or may be that M&M harmed them by not repaying the Kroger proceeds. We, of course, contend that M&M was not a party to that initial loan. They weren't obligated on that initial loan. Only Alton Isabel was. More importantly, we contend what's missing from this timeline and the evidence and the record in this case is any documentation or sufficient evidence to establish the strict tracing requirement that the Laytons' money actually got to M&M or its property. There are no bank statements. There are no wire transfer records. There's the testimony of Alton Isabel, which, frankly, was contradictory and confusing. He testified on one hand unequivocally that the only commercial developments, Kroger, grocery stores of any kind, were on the west side of Highway 731. The record, the evidence at trial showed, however, that the real estate that M&M came into possession of came from Deer Creek Estates, which everybody agreed unequivocally was on the east side of Highway 731. Thus, our emphasis in our briefing on the money being used on the west, M&M being on the east. Beyond that, even though, our contention is that there is no sufficient documentation in the record showing that M&M actually got this money. There's no evidence in the record about how they got it, other than Alton Isabel, when that happened, and again, how it happened. Part of the problem with the timeline is that Alton Isabel bought that property, the 525 acres that came to be split off, part of which came into possession of M&M and is the property at issue, in the earlier mid-90s, long before the Laytons were ever considering making their loans. So we know that the Laytons' money could not have been used to purchase the property, was not purchase money on the property. So how else could it have gotten involved with M&M, whose sole asset was this real estate?
So the gist of what you're saying is that Isabel's testimony, which is basically all that's there, isn't sufficient to prove where the money went.
Neither Isabel's testimony or Ledford White's testimony on these issues is sufficient.
And, no, and it's just because it's conflicting and contradictory? Is that the basis?
In large part, and because there's no documentary evidence to support it.
Well, is there case law that says there has to be documentary evidence?
I think
so. Or would testimony be sufficient if it was sufficiently clear?
In theory, I would agree with you that testimony could be sufficient. In this case, it's not because of the east-west issue combined with no supporting documentation.
I know that it has to be traced, but is there a higher burden of proof?
Strict tracing is the burden of proof.
Right, and, but is it proof by a preponderance of the evidence as opposed to clear and convincing? It's preponderance, right?
It is preponderance, absolutely. Okay. I would agree with that, but it's got to be the same property traced there. What we've got here is money going out in 2000 and no real evidence about what happened to it until down here in 2012. Part of the issue is what could that money have been used for M&M on that property? There's some evidence that maybe some construction went on M&M's property in 2008, but in the larger bulk of the evidence suggests that dirt started getting pushed around in 2012 sometime. Where was the Laytons' money between 2001, when Kroger was about to sell, and when that work on M&M started? There's no evidence of that. There's no real discussion of it from either Mr. Isabel or Mr. White that I'm aware of. And we contend that that's not strict tracing. There's no evidence about how much Kroger sold for, what the other investors got, what Alton put in his pocket, what he did with that money, what bank it went to. None of that. This money is out in the ether for 12 years and supposedly comes down and lands on this real property in the 2012-2013 timeframe. And that is our primary concern here, is that the evidence of strict tracing is simply not there. We briefed the issue, and I don't want to emphasize it heavily in argument today, but fraud, conspiracy, and aiding and abetting are not there against M&M either. It was very... May I finish briefly?
Finish your sentence or thought, please.
It was very telling in the Layton's response brief addressing the harm from the supposed fraud when they said that the harm was M&M not giving them their promised share of the Kroger proceeds. And in fact, the jury found that $0 in damages resulted from any reliance of the Layton's on promises from M&M. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Let's see, Mr. Kimball.
Please the court, counsel. I'm going to argue for White and White PC, and I will use White as the global term for both parties. I'm going to answer your question quickly. Judge Livingston, Mr. Layton never tried to collect his debt until August of 2013. He did not try to collect it, and that's my issues here. Jury question 19 was a discovery rule, and again, we're going to live with this timeline here, and I'm going to go through it pretty quickly. $280,000, 1997 and 2000, were given to Isbell for development of the Kroger property, the Crowley property. 2001, Layton, White, and Isbell are in Alaska on a hunting trip. Fax came over, showed Mr. Layton that he's working on the deal. Here's the deal, we're selling the Kroger, are you going to get your money? That gave Mr. Layton some notice that his money was coming or that something was going to happen and he was going to get paid. 4 years go by, 2005, 2006, Layton drives by and sees the Kroger's built. Right there is actual notice that he has an actionable injury. He should have then presented to the Dutch School some reasonable diligence. He drove by, he saw it was done, and he did nothing until 2013. 2008 was the latest that Layton should have known that he had an actionable injury because he did not have his money and the Kroger was completed. On the discovery rule for the floor plan, same thing applies, although this timeline isn't here. In 2000, and about the same time, Layton loaned $200,000 to Mike Parks for a car floor plan. Again, 2005, Layton came to White, and White didn't have the money. And he should have known at that time he was at least out $200,000. I mean, when you say, I don't have the money, he knows right then and there that he's got there's some reasonable view there that you've got an actionable injury. In 2005, Layton even asked White to sue Parks for that money. So at 2005, he knew he was out $200,000. And at this point in 2007, when there was another $200,000 loaned, he's out $400,000 at this point. And again, in 2007, the payment stopped. He went to White. I don't have the money. Right then and there in 2007, 6 years before he decided to collect on his debt. The jury, there's testimony that, and the basis for the April 13 finding was, is that White was out at Layton's on a turkey hunt. He told Layton that they're not going to get their money. And the jury relied solely on that evidence right there, that April 13 was when Layton should have known he wasn't going to get his money. But this timeline, 17, and anybody that's got an understanding of what, you know, the man's out $680,000 by 2008, 2007. I think you would have reason to believe at that point in 2008 that you're not getting your money. Additionally, There's no evidence that White knew that Isbell or Parks wouldn't pay back, okay? And there was some issues there. So questions 19, 20, and 21 should be described and reversed and rendered in favor of White because the reasonable diligence standard upon Mr. Layton is easily proven by his testimony on Exhibit 17.
You argue in your brief that it's against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence.
Yes.
But isn't it really a legal standard at some point?
Oh, it absolutely.
A factual standard?
It's a matter of law that this, he should have, in these timelines of his testimony, these, and in my JNOB, I argued that, pursuant to the discovery rule standard, he was well on notice by the end of 2008 that he should have been, and this, the court should have taken it out of the jury's hands, period, end of conversation. I don't disagree with you at all. It is a matter of law. All the causes of action with 4 year or less statute of limitations should be barred strictly on the limitations alone.
But on great weight and preponderance standard, it would be a remand rather than a render.
Okay, well, we can do a remand. I don't mind either way. But all of the cause of actions less than 4 years should be dismissed. On the fraud claim question one, there's actual testimony that White was given the money and gave it to Layton, and White actually gave the money to Layton and Isbell and to Parks. There's no question, no intent of fraud there, because Layton knew that the money was gone, and Layton knew that he was looking to Parks and Isbell for repayment. Question number two, statutory fraud should be rendered back simply because the statutory fraud, there is no evidence and absolutely contrary evidence, contrary testimony, that there was never a real estate contract entered into between White and Layton. Question three, exemplary damages as to question two, the chapter 27. Since there's no contract of real estate property, there should be no exemplary damages attached to that question. 5A on the theft, wrongful appropriation, and without consent and intent to deprive. There's no unlawful appropriation here because Layton freely gave his money to White to give to Isbell and Parks. Layton knew the money was going into Isbell and Parks. May I finish?
Yes.
And Layton looked strictly to Isbell and Parks for repayment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. All right, Mr. Warren.
May it please the court. We are not seeking to make new law. We're relying on old law and old and established law. With respect to M&M joint venture, we are not turning constructive trust or lien law on its head. We're following the laws of constructive trust. The problem that M&M has is they want to rely on the fact now that Mr. Davis in 2013 obtained an interest in M&M somehow excuses M&M of its past deeds, its past sins. That's not the law. Ledford White, in fact, in Defense Exhibit 16, showed that he was the managing joint venture of the M&M from 2003, its creation, all the way through 2013, 10 years. For 5 years of that, Isbell was another 50% owner. During that time period of their ownership, during that time period when Mr. White was the managing joint venture, first, he testified that he kept no books. It's on, I believe, volume 3, page 229. He kept no books of M&M's transactions. M&M comes in now and says, we failed to prove tracing because we don't have documents. Well, whose fault is that? Does M&M get to get out of its problem because its managing joint venture failed to keep books? And that the only testimony, the only evidence by which we can establish a constructive trust is through the direct testimony of the people who owned it at the time, which it does, not just, in my opinion, by preponderance of the evidence, but by clear and convincing evidence. Now, with respect to the notion that, well, what we're trying to get a constructive trust on is something that happened in 2001 for a Kroger property. But let's look at, again, the managing joint venture of M&M's direct testimony. I'm volume 4, beginning on page 96. I asked Mr. White, You told Mr. Layton that your property from the Kroger went into, the proceeds from the Kroger went into other Crowley property, and you were going to get paid back from a later sale. Yes? That was after I talked to Mr. Isbell. So it's fair to say, while you were the managing joint venture of M&M, you told Mr. Layton that his proceeds from the Kroger sale were invested into other property and would be paid back from it, correct? That is what Mr. Isbell told me, yes, and I told him. Question, that was a new promise, was it not? The old representation that your money was given to Mr. Isbell and you're going to be paid back from Kroger, yes. Now we have a new representation. Your money from Kroger is put into other Crowley property and you're going to be paid back from it. It's a new promise, yes. And he went on to agree with me that Mr. Layton had the right, once he learned of the Kroger sale, to ask for his money from that, but he gave up that right because of this new promise. He relied on this new promise made by Mr. White while managing joint venture of M&M in 2006. And then Mr. Layton and Mr. Isbell and Mr. White all consisted in what happened next. Next, White calls Mr. Isbell and says, I want you to call Gwen Layton and I want you to show him where his money is. Mr. Isbell testified very directly. There's no conflicting testimony about this, that he called Mr. Layton, using the phone number provided to him by Mr. White, and said, I want to show you where your money is. He took him to the property owned by M&M, and in 2007, and I disagree with Mr. Anderson on this point, that nothing was done in 2012, because Mr. Isbell's testimony was very clear that he had equipment working out there when he drove Mr. Layton around that property in 2007, and took him on a tour of the property that he said was owned by M&M, pointed to the ground and said, this is where your money is. So we have clear tracing. The Laytons were owed their money from the Kroger sale. Mr. White and Mr. Isbell put that money in M&M. Mr. Isbell testified that the money was used to develop M&M's property. Mr. White testified that he promised Mr. Layton that he'd be paid from proceeds from that property, the property that Mr. Isbell showed him.
What was the reliance, though?
Reliance was giving up their right to demand their money back in 2007 when they learned the cover had been sold.
And what in the record supports that theory that they did actually rely in that manner?
Mr. White's testimony, again, picking up in Volume 4, I believe on 97, with that same line of questioning. And based on your new representation, he did not pursue that right, but instead waited and allowed his funds to remain invested wherever they were in the Crowley property and wait to be paid back at a future date, correct? And Mr. White said, yes. And the Supreme Court has told us, with respect to reliance, that it's not always action. It's inaction. We cited in our brief, I believe, if you bear with me, forgive me, I can't find it quickly in my notes, but I know we cited in a brief a case that makes that point from the Texas Supreme Court very clear that inaction, here we go, Thornton versus Prospect High Income, 314-913, Southwest 3rd, 913, the page side is 928.
Did the Laytons testify as to reliance?
They testified that they did not pursue their money following Mr. White's representation, I believe. But it's clear they did not, in fact, pursue
it. Well, they didn't pursue it, but did they not pursue it in reliance on that misrepresentation? Did they testify to that?
I believe so. I believe it. Well, they, in fact, they always testified that the reason they never pursued their money was because they kept getting reassurances from Mr. White. Remember, Mr. Layton testified that I asked, where's my money? When can I get repaid? And Mr. White continually told him.
Right, but did he ever connect the dots and say, I didn't demand my money because I was assured, because of this misrepresentation? We know from the facts that they didn't, but were those two ideas connected in any manner?
I believe the record shows that they were, because Mr. Layton testified time and again that he did not get his money back and did not demand it back because of the assurances from Mr. White. I mean, that is the reason. In fact, the jury found that there was fraudulent concealment. and that there was no reason to believe that they had been wronged by Mr. White until 2013. And remember, I want to go back to this point that was made by Mr. Kimball. Well, they should have known. Maybe in a normal circumstance, maybe. That would be true. But don't forget what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a man who had been their lawyer for decades. And more than just their lawyer, he had been their trusted friend. Mr. White even conceded that the Laytons had no reason to doubt my word in 2012. That's his direct testimony. He testified that they went on trips together, carnival or cruises, trip to Alaska. They routinely had dinner in each other's homes. They played softball together in their younger days. And in their older days, they were pallbearers at the deaths of family members of their of friends and family. These were close, close friends. And don't forget, it wasn't just that Mr. White was misleading them. He had an affirmative duty to disclose. Yet he, time and time again for years, told them complete untruths. And we know, for example, that while the very time that he was telling Mr. Layton, there aren't any sales in that property. We've had some tire kickers. People are looking at it, but there aren't any sales. But when there are, you're going to get your money. But what we know was really happening, over $1 million in interest in that property were being sold to Chesapeake, the city of Crowley, and others. And where did that money go? It went to Mr. White, some to Mr. Isbell, and even $50,000 to Kent Davis before his lawsuit. It's amazing to me that we are being told today that my clients, who are the only folks in this room who are out money out of their pocket, retirement money that they paid out, are not entitled to any interest in the land that was used to develop their property and are not entitled to any recovery, even though they are the only folks in this room who actually put money into it. Constructive trust is an equitable remedy. And I fail to see how the equities in this case do not lie directly with Gwynn and Ann Layton. Now, there are some notions in the briefing, and well, there's no fraud because we can't show that White intended to defraud them when their money was taken, whether it was in 2001 or in 2007 when he's making his new promises. But the law is clear that intent is something that's in the purview of the jury. And the jury found fraud in clear and convincing evidence. And the law is further clear that you can base your finding of an intent to defraud on the subsequent activities and promises of the defrauder. And what do we know was happening here? Again, from 2007 through 2013, White's telling my clients, nothing's being sold. People are looking at it. People might be interested, but nothing's being sold. And at the same time, with his other hand, while wearing his imminent venture cap, he's pocketing over $1 million in income. He's funneling it through his law firm's escrow account. And he's funneling it to himself, despite what his testimony is. I believe his tax returns are very clear on that point, to Mr. Isbell, and also, again, $50,000 to Mr. Davis.
And did the evidence show that he was still acting as both parties' attorneys, both as to the Laytons and Isbell during virtually all of this time?
I believe the testimony showed that he had done work from the sales of their property and title work, and he had represented Mr. Layton in an ordinance issue down in Stephenville. Forgive me, I don't have the dates exactly in my head, but yes, I believe the evidence shows that during this entire time, he was not only still acting as their attorney on matters, but of course also was their close personal friend. That didn't end until 2013, when the final effects, when he finally came clean. And it's interesting to me that he came clean on the last day, actually the last minutes of a hunting trip. Mr. White had gone to land owned by my client and spent 2 to 3 days there with his family that he had brought to have a hunt on Mr. Layton's property. And when he's walking out the door is when he tells Mr. Layton, hey, you know, I may have been wrong. I don't think you're going to get your money back. That's when he finally told my clients what was going on. Now, with respect to Mr. Parks, I want to talk briefly about this car loan deal. Mr. Kimber made a point that, well, he was told, Mr. Layton was told by Mr. White, Well, Mr. Parks has your money, and he hasn't paid it back in 2000. I can't remember the time frame. Sometime between 2001 and 2005. But that's not the whole story. The rest of the story is, but I've got a lien on Mr. Parks' home, and that home is worth over $1 million. And what does he do? And something reminiscent of what happened on the Crowley property, he takes him on a drive, shows him the house, and says, look there. That's where we're going to get your money back up. I can foreclose on that house and take it. So don't worry. Your property is safe. Your money is safe. And he continued to tell Mr. Layton that all the way through 2012. What he didn't tell Mr. Layton, and also going to show an intent to defraud, is the house wasn't in Mr. Parks' name. It was in Mr. White's. There was no foreclosure, no lien to take money that belonged to Mr. Parks and pay him back. He was pointing to a house that Mr. White was leasing to Mr. Parks. All along, we have a dear friend, a trusted advisor, a long-time attorney, making continued promises to the Laytons. The only folks who were out money, who took money out of their pocket and put it in the hands of Mr. White or into property that was developed, are the Laytons. And the testimony is very clear from Mr. Isbell. It is not equivocating. He says, in no uncertain terms, the property that the Layton's money went into was the property owned by M&M. He had equipment out there the day he showed it to Mr. Layton. And even Mr. White testified that money used to develop property becomes part of the property. It becomes part of the land because it can't be taken back out. Now, I want to say one quick final thing about the East versus West controversy. One, Mr. Isbell's testimony, again, was very direct that it was the property owned by M&M, and apparently the jury and the judge believed him on that point. But I would ask the court to go back and look at the two amended motions to dismiss our list pendants, the motion for summary judgment, the JNOV, and the motion to modify the judgment to see if that argument was ever made before it showed up in this court, after the evidence had closed. I think you will find that there is no mention in any of those motions of an East versus West argument being made until we appeared here. Unless the judges have any questions for me, that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Warren. All right, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. I would take issue with several of the points that Mr. Warren made. One, he glossed over the idea that anything that Mr. White or Mr. Isbell did at any point in time was obviously on behalf of M&M. That's not true. The record is very problematic in the lack of evidence or specificity of the evidence about when a lot of this stuff happened. Alton Isbell was no longer involved or owner of M&M as of, I think, September 2008. And the all-important drive around the property did not necessarily occur before then. The record's not clear on it, but it could have been 2009 per Mr. Layton's own testimony. Per Mr. Isbell's testimony, he was acting in his individual capacity and doesn't know of any reason why the Laytons would have thought he was doing anything on behalf of M&M at that point in time, or at any point in time, which makes sense because the Laytons' own testimony was they didn't know that M&M existed until approximately 2013. Other property, that keeps getting brought up, other property. Our contention is that it's not specific enough for lien purposes or strict tracing purposes. If we are at the point where driving around and pointing at some property, and the Laytons can't tell you which property it was, in fact, he said he could no more fly to the moon than he could tell you which property that was or exactly where it was. If we're at the point where that gives rise to an ownership interest in real property, then we have indeed turned lien law and constructive trust law on its head. There's a reason that we file deeds in the county records. It's to announce to the world that there's an interest in the property, to put them on notice, to put people on like Kent Davis on notice that someone else out there has a claim to this property that he is litigating over with Ledford White at the very moment the Laytons are supposedly learning about all this stuff. There's a reason we do that. The last point I would bring up just briefly, it goes to the fraud issue, the harms resulting from the supposed fraud by M&M. The jury was asked a couple, what I would call promissory estoppel questions in question number 13 and 14. They found in question 13 that the Laytons relied to their detriment on M&M's promises, and in question 14 they said they suffered $0 in harm from that reliance. M&M's not liable for direct fraud. They're not liable for furthering an ongoing conspiracy of any kind. And the bottom line is, by Mr. Layton's own testimony, he suffered no, and this is his testimony, no new cash financial harm at the time, this 2006 through 2009 time frame, based on what he's hearing from Ledford White. The damage was done when the ill-advised loans were made in 1997 and in 2000. And if we allow the Laytons to assert some kind of hovering lien that can land on Ledford White's possibly last asset 15 years later, we are letting constructive trust turn into a method to pre-collect a judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Kimball?
Two quick points, Your Honor. Your question about whether or not White was acting as the attorney in this matter, he was not. Testimony by all the parties said that. He was a conduit between Layton and Isbell and Parks. He couldn't be an attorney for all of them because he would have been conflicted out because he represented all of them at some point in time and still did in other matters. White was only the conduit, and the testimony was that I told Layton what Isbell or Parks told me to tell them. Those promises were not White's promises or misrepresentations. They were Isbell's and Parks' misrepresentations, because White, being the conduit, and Layton knew that he wasn't looking to White to get paid. White didn't have the money. It was very clear that White just passed the money to Layton, from Layton to Isbell and Parks. It's very clear, and his testimony says so. Mr. Layton is not an ignorant man. He turned a garage-based business into a multi-million dollar project and enterprise, and he sold it with the help of Mr. White, and it had a significant amount of cash that he would like to invest. Isbell came to White. White said, yeah, I've got a guy that wants to develop some property. Loaned him the money. With all due respect to Mr. White and Mr. Garrett and Mr. Warren, they laid Mr. Layton look like somebody that couldn't manage his own milk money. But here, right here on this exhibit, and the testimony and his ability to understand what his money is about shows that he knew at multiple times he wasn't going to get paid. Whether or not Isbell told White that, hey, we're going to move this money over here or move it over there, that was not White's misrepresentation or White's promise. That was Isbell's misrepresentation and or Parks' misrepresentation told White to pass on to the Laytons. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. If not, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. Want to thank all the attorneys for all their briefing in this matter. We also appreciate your oral arguments today in coming to the court. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court.
All right. Now stand in the dungeon.